Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Adrian Van Young, who has a terrific new novel out, Shadows in Summerland. We'll also be celebrating National Poetry Month with Mark Jakic, author of Poetry, A Survivor's Manual, and Carolyn Hembree, author of Rigging Your Chevy into a Time Machine and Other Ways to Escape a Plague. Adrian Van Young is the author of the award-winning story collection, The Man Who Noticed Everything, published in 2011. Today, we'll be talking about his new novel, his first, Shadows in Summerland, a spookily wonderful tale inspired by the golden age of spiritualism. Adrian lives in New Orleans with his wife, Darcy, and son, Sebastian, and teaches creative writing at Tulane University. Adrian Van Young, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
I feel like I should be rapping on the table to summon the spirits to talk to you about this book. So what attracted you to spiritualism as a topic and this time?
I think what attracted me to spirit photography initially, which was really what got me afterwards into spiritualism, was that I saw an exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. And the exhibit was called Photography and the Occult, and it was a spirit photography exhibit geared specifically towards that. And it came out, I believe, around Halloween time, 2008. Ooh. And that was where I first saw the photographs of William Mumler, who's one of the central characters in the book, sort of reimagined in the book. And that initially was what got me into spirit photography, and then spiritualism itself came afterwards. I didn't really know much about it, but as I kind of looked deeper and deeper into the movement, I was actually shocked at what a liberal movement it was. Oh. And what an interesting movement it was politically, and how it had championed all these causes like women's rights and abolition and all these things that I had had no idea that it had been involved in. And that was one thing that actually attracted me, was that it had this interesting political and social dimension. And then, of course, I love all the sort of trappings of spiritualism, you know, the trickery and sort of the gloom and doom and the floating instruments in the cabinets.
Mm-hmm. Describe for us a little bit what you mean by spirit photography.
Spirit photography was pioneered by this fellow, William H. Mumler. It was the late 1850s in Boston, Massachusetts, and then later on in New York City, where actually the book never goes. But in real life, Mumler worked first in Boston and then New York, and then returned to Boston, where he died in poverty and obscurity in the 1870s. And what spirit photography was, essentially, Mumler and others like him, there were other spirit photographers soon after him, but he was the only one at his time. Would be to have somebody come in for a sitting. Essentially, what they would do would be to take a picture of the individual and then to double expose the photographic plate so that somebody approximating a lost loved one would appear in the photograph next to them. But the interesting thing about Mumler was that he did this for many years and actually made quite a bit of money doing it. But then finally, when he was put on trial for fraud and larceny in the early 1860s, I believe, he was actually acquitted because nobody could prove his process was fake, which is one of the things that also drew me into the subject initially, because I thought, well, perhaps, you know, there's some kind of unseen element here that could be capitalized upon in a novel.
Well, spiritualism offers such a rich emotional and intellectual spectrum of things to draw on. You know, what is more human than wanting to contact a dead loved one? And of course, what is more human than to be a con artist about it, you know?
Absolutely. And I love what your first insight, I think, is really true, that it is such a human element. There's something profoundly inhuman and bizarre about spiritualism, and yet there is a human dimension to it, which is really tender and really kind of moving. And actually, a lot of the historical records, when you read about these people ceaselessly trying to contact their dead relatives, there's something kind of beautiful about that. So that was the thing that drew me emotionally into the book, for sure. And then, the fraud that enters into it is extremely intriguing, and it's so American, it strikes me. I mean, there are a lot of parallels between what Mumler was doing more than 200 years ago now and stuff that's even going on today. I mean, even watching, you know, the political race, I'm constantly drawing parallels between the rhetoric of some of the politicians and Mumler.
There's a thought. Bring this book all the way into the present. I love it. Oh, and there's also this element of witch hunting to it, too, which I found so fascinating. This constant desire to disprove the spiritualists.
Yes, which was a very interesting contradiction in terms, actually, at the time, because spiritualism and spirit photography in many ways were thought to be very scientific, which is fascinating. There were a lot of things mixed up in spiritualism, like the humors and mesmerism, these things that have ostensibly scientific principles, even though they're total gobbledygook in some ways. And spiritualism drew on those things. And of course, photography at the time was thought to be this indelibly like scientific process, right? Like what a camera could capture was the truest depiction of nature or the truest depiction of anything really on record at the time.
What belief we had in photography.
Yes.
You know, it's interesting, isn't it? Ah, so tell us about some of the historical figures who populate this book, because there are several and it's fun to read about them.
Well, Mumler himself, the photographer, was an actual individual whose life's chronology is more or less charted by the novel. And in fact, I should say, and I do go out of my way several times to say in the book, just so there isn't any confusion, that although these were real individuals, this is what I like to call a revisionist historical novel. It's a revisionist history. There are things in it that are completely extrapolated from the research that I did about these people's lives, complete leaps in logic that aren't necessarily even close to what actually comprised their lives. Mumler's life in the novel, I'd say, is the closest to his actual life, although the other main characters, who I would actually consider in some ways to be more principal than Mumler, his wife, Hannah Mumler, and then the spirit medium, Fanny Conant, J.H. Conant, in real life, were also actual people. And their pasts, I think, are more so imagined even than Mumler's.
I love Fanny. She was one of my favorite characters.
Thanks. She's actually my favorite, too.
That's good. So feisty, you know, and so, I don't know, so determined. Now, I know this is going to sound like a bit of a strange question, but I often feel that death is so present here in New Orleans. You know, we live with it every day and such an awareness of death at every turn. Was that helpful to you at all, to be living here while you were writing this book?
It was, actually. The book took me about 8 years to research, write, and revise, and I lived in three different cities over the course of that time. I began the book living in New York City, and then I wrote a large part of the first and second draft in Boston, and then I finished it in New Orleans, which is very fitting in a way. But yes, to answer your question, absolutely. I find living in New Orleans to be incredibly inspirational as a writer. Not only is there a wonderful literary community, Thank you. But moreover, it is such an atmospheric city, and it has such a theatrical relationship to death, but it also has, as you mentioned, a very real and sort of poignant relationship with death. And so I think that kind of admixture of those things was very helpful, especially putting the finishing touches on a novel. So much of that is kind of amping up the mood here, dimming it down there. And so much of it is sort of soundtracking the book in a way.
Yes.
And New Orleans was a wonderful city in which to do that.
Well, it's a really wonderful book. I find myself so haunted by these characters. Their voices are so distinct and interesting. You know, they never quit talking to you after the book is over.
Thank you.
Uh-oh. I'm confessing, you know. We've been talking with Adrian Van Young, whose beautiful and haunting new novel, his first, is Shadows in Summerland. You can meet him Thursday, April 21st at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Adrian, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Susan.
Mark Jakic is a poet, the author of many books, and a professor of English at Loyola University, where he is also the editor of the New Orleans Review. Today, we're talking about his most recent book, Poetry, A Survivor's Guide. Oh, Mark, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
Now, when I think of poetry, I think of loving it, reading it, writing it, not surviving it.
Well, for many years, I was just surviving it.
You think?
I started out detesting poetry. I was not one of those kids who loved reading, loved Dr. Seuss. I couldn't stand Green Eggs and Ham. In high school, I was made to write papers on Matthew Arnold. Dover Beach
was my...
I loathed that poem for so many years. And then I was living abroad, and I didn't have many friends. I was living in Belgium, actually, and I found an English language bookstore, and the shortest things were poems to read. So I started grabbing these books of poems and reading them, and some of the poems became friends.
Now, when you were writing this, who was your imaginary reader? Readers of poetry, writers of poetry?
That's a good question. The book is dedicated to my students.
Yes.
So if I did have an audience, it was definitely my students. Oftentimes in teaching poetry over the last 10 or 15 years, I found myself repeating myself a lot in class.
Yeah.
So I decided to write some of these things down I kept saying in class, and they started to snowball, and then the book kind of came out of that in a large way.
And the form is so lovely because it's short. It's episodic. You can read a brief essay like a day, and it would be a wonderful guide for a writer or a reader.
Right. That was my other thing is my first book I ever did love was a book of quotations. It was the first book I ever bought was a book of quotations. They were short. I could get them. They were pithy. So for some reason, I came back to that years later. In this book, you can open it anywhere and read just a sentence or a paragraph, and they're pithy, and they're not meant to be the end-all, be-all of let's say, imagery or rhyme,
right.
But they're meant to be a launching point for discussion.
They're like brief and lovely meditations, you know? I can see you writing it and sitting back and going, okay.
Well, there were a lot that never made it.
Uh-huh.
The book is 200 pages. There were probably like 600 pages of stuff. And sometimes I sit back with those meditations and think, that one's just too cheesy, or that one's too sentimental, or that one's too rough. And so it took a lot of rewriting.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book is divided into two sections, reading, which I love, of course, and writing. And I love some of the things you said, particularly about Emily Dickinson and the difficult, especially her imaginary biography today. Say that for me, would you?
Well, everyone thinks Emily Dickinson, they think the recluse in the attic, the old maid. But she wrote these kind of strange, austere, bizarre poems that are impenetrable. She takes some getting used to, I admit, the poems. But once you, I don't want to say crack them, because you never quite get them, which is part of their great mystery. Once you start to like them after a while, living with them, there's nothing like them. I would take her book of collected poems, Desert Island, for sure.
Yeah.
There's this mythology around, you know, all kinds of writers, especially ones we don't know much about. But Emma Dickinson, if you start looking at some of the information we have, she loved to bake. So she'd bake for kids in the neighborhood, her family, of course. She was not exactly a recluse, but that's what she's, you know, it sounds better.
Uh-huh. I love the way you described her as Emily Dickinson divides her time between the kitchen and the bedroom.
When I do think about her, I think that's how she was. She was in the kitchen. She wrote poems in the kitchen. It's obvious because on the back of some of the recipes she was using, there's drafts of poems.
Mm-hmm. And he said something that I thought was really quite wonderful. If you're telling someone to read Emily Dickinson, you don't say, she'll grow on you. The book will grow on you. You will grow into the book.
Yeah, I think that's something I try and get across to my students is if you have to relate to a poem and have to identify with it, you're not reading it sufficiently. Try and go with the poem. Let it show you something that you hadn't seen before, not something that you already know.
I wonder if you'd read a little section of this book. It's a section on spirituality, and I particularly liked it.
Spirituality. Poems are apparitions of what they once were, poised between piety and desire. They are mechanisms of suddenness that spring from a want for mystical or spiritual life. When you're standing in front of a river surging down a mountain, you don't think to yourself, I wonder what that means. You simply take in the experience. But then you remember a line from a dead German poet, beauty is nothing but the beginning of a terror that we are barely able to endure. Every angel is terrible. These words conjure up his ghost, but that angel is all yours. Proust said that reading only introduces us to a spiritual life. It does not constitute it. Writing, he forgot to add, constitutes it. Humans invented God because looking over the precipice of a cliff is both terrifying and exhilarating. But the unknown is a mystery too mysterious. The idea of God made the mysterious less so, and eventually prepared us for seeking out new mysteries, those of science. Poetry's mysteries, by comparison or contrast, have never left us. The older one gets, the stranger God becomes. Poetry is a way of being estranged from the world, like the god one wishes to become. Poetry, like all religions, has its spiritual problems. Christians must recall that the Lord and Jesus were united in a murder-suicide pact. Jews must recall that being the chosen people was their choice. Buddhists must recall that Buddha abandoned his wife and infant son to become Buddha. Atheists must recall that God has authored a book in which God doesn't exist.
I love that.
I had fun in that part.
I knew you did.
I mean, honestly, I struggle with God. You know, I talk to the God I don't believe in. It's a very humbling thing.
I know. I love that God has authored a book in which God does not exist particularly. But one of the things I find about poets is that they're often in dialogue with other poets, and they're extremely generous in sharing the love of work that inspires them. And this is a book with great generosity, and you talk about many of the poems and poets who mean so much to you. So I wonder if you'd recommend some of those poets.
Wow. And besides Emily Dickinson, of course, which, you know, everyone recommends, but you really have to find your own connection to her. Frank O'Hara is this poet that everyone's heard about, but I really think he's an underrated love poet.
Uh-huh.
We think about him as the, I do this, I walked around New York City during my lunch hour and just took down little notes and anecdotes and vignettes. But if you get his collected, which is out by the University of California, Berkeley Press, it's about, I don't know, 300-400 pages. It's a great love Bible. He wrote all these poems that never anthologized, but they're these beautiful, quirky love poems. And I really think he's underrated when it comes to love. Recently, Mitya Harvey is one of my favorites, and she's been around for 15 years publishing. But her book, Pity the Bathtub, Its Forced Embrace of the Human Form.
Oh, what a great title.
It's a beautiful title. When I first got that book in 1999, I remember thinking, this is the book I've been waiting for.
Uh-huh.
It had these just really stunning enjambments, these spillover lines. And I mentioned that these particular enjambments she makes, they're really gorgeous. Some of the Eastern European poets were some of my first loves. When I was living in Brussels all those years ago, I picked up, you know, all these Eastern European poets, Vasco Popa, Zaba Gayo Erbert. I mean, all these poets who most Americans aren't familiar with, and that's okay, mm-hmm. but they were my first loves, writing strange little neo-surrealist poems about forks and knives and little boxes.
So I think you'd be a wonderful teacher, Mark.
Thank you.
It would be fun to be in your class. And reading Poetry or Survivor's Guide is like being in a class with the best kind of teacher, I think. Funny and irreverent and very wise.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Mark Jakic, who's the author of Poetry, A Survivor's Guide. You can meet him April 21st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. It's National Poetry Month, people. Celebrate it. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Hembry is an assistant professor of English at the University of New Orleans. She teaches creative writing and is the poetry editor for Bayou Magazine. The last time we met, we were talking about her fabulous debut collection, Skinny. And now Carolyn's back with the wonderfully titled Rigging a Chevy into a Time Machine and Other Ways to Escape a Plague, just out in time for National Poetry Month. Carolyn Hembry, I am so happy to see you again.
Susan, I am always so happy to see you.
So these poems are telling this urgent, fascinating story, and taken together, they form a kind of narrative. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the character at the center of all this, Vitalis Kleb. Where did this name come from?
The name actually came from a great uncle named Vitalis, about whom little is known. As far as the characters go, I guess place was the first character that came to me. And was sort of always with me, and that the setting is Tennessee, 1973-ish for much of, though that starts to shift in the last section, but for much of the book, where I was born. I was born in Bristol, Tennessee, and my father's family has been there since pre-revolutionary times when they came over as squatters from Virginia. The core narrative, the interior narrative, which starts to sort of fracture and become a multiverse in the last section of the book. But the core narrative, I would say, is based on a murder ballad. V Club came to me first. and then his girlfriend, Eye Candy, their child, Adeline. Eye Candy took me a lot longer. She was sort of, not to bring up a god of literature, but she was sort of like the caddy, you know, Faulkner's caddy. Yes. She just kept slipping through my fingers. So it took a lot of work to deepen her, but Club was kind of already there and sort of was the space for me as well. And then there are peripheral characters like Mama Club, Vitalis's mother, Sears Catalog Girl, who is a Christ of sorts, who offers grace, and the Forebears, which is a chorus of ancestors who speak to V Club through parables, fables, and so on.
Well, one of the things about the entire book is this furious energy. I mean, I really enjoyed the forward momentum of it, the driving language, and it's just vibrating. I mean, I imagine you vibrating when you write these poems. However, you know, we think of poets as, you know, the careful choosers, the ones who deliberate for ages over a single word choice. And I'm curious to know how you balance that care for your work with that energy of the entire collection.
I'm brutal with revision of the work. I probably, hundreds of pages didn't make it in that were there originally.
Wow.
So I skewer it. As far as the forward momentum, that's just a sensibility. I think I like the litany. I like poetry that, yes, grips and sort of, though I also do enjoy resting places or quieter poems. And I think there are some in there that are more meditative that pull back.
Oh, yes.
A bit, but you're right. I mean, it's a gut punch.
Well, why don't you read one for us?
Absolutely. What place, then, for a creator? The dead girl decks herself in red bud, red algae, red-shouldered hawk for Kleb. She swims through reeds to his sick room. She burns sassafras in the mountain cave. She steeps black elder tea. She reads, is smoke, is smoke, is smoke. She hangs gourds in a china berry. She hangs china berry and owl in eventide. She charms him with water moccasins. She charms them from water, from skins, from cans of lard. She puts her fingers and tongue through a trailage of green heron horse nettle. She molds double vowels to her gums. Sweet gum, woolly, adelgid. She speaks through fever dreams in tongues without skulls. She is like the blood thrown from his window. She greens his sunken chassis in splendor. Oh, earthen vessel. Oh, living water. Oh, algaic angel.
Sigh. That's all I can say. Sigh. Oh, God. Carolyn, you read so beautifully. You do. Is reading the great tool for revision for you, or is it looking at the words on the page?
It's both, but I speak for much of the time that I'm writing, actually, the process from the beginning to the end, I'm saying the words to generate the writing and also to revise it, to hear it.
Now, this collection won the Trio House Award. What did that mean to you?
It won the Trio Award and it won the Marsh Hawk Rochelle Ratner Award. So I was blown away. It's meant a lot to me. First and foremost, to be with Trio House Press because it's a collective of sensitive, intelligent, kind, and open-minded readers, poets, and editors. So that, for one, first and foremost, that I was connected to them meant a lot. I admire Neil Shepard's work, who was the judge for this prize, and I knew when I was submitting, you know, that he would be looking at it, and I feel sort of simpatico with his work, so it meant a lot. Obviously, it's a huge honor. I feel lucky. I know the numbers game, and I've been sending my work out for a long, long time, and I feel honored.
And here's this beautiful book. We've been talking with poet Carolyn Hembree, whose new book is Rigging a Chevy into a Time Machine and Other Ways to Escape a Plague. You can meet her Tuesday, May 3rd in the 1718 Reading Series at the Columns Hotel at 7 o'clock. Carolyn, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. William Barnwell discusses in Signs Call to Heal the Brokenhearted, stories from Cairo's Prison Ministry International, Tuesday, April 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The New Orleans Public Library partners with Esoterotica for an evening of readings, featuring, in their words, lascivious language and sensual stanzas, Tuesday, April 19th from 8 to 10, upstairs at Mimi's in the Marigny. Christopher Fatweis, professor of U.S. Foreign Policy and National Security at Tulane University, discusses the Iran nuclear deal, Wednesday, April 20th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Adrian Van Young, signs Shadows in Summerland, Thursday, April 21st at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Melissa Ginsberg reads from and signs her new mystery, Sunset City, Thursday, April 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Michael Murphy signs Hear Dat New Orleans, a guide to the rich musical heritage and lively current scene, Thursday, April 21st at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Mark Jakic, discusses the importance of poetry and signs Poetry, a Survivor's Manual, Thursday, April 21st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Bill Lofelm and Cassie Prine are the featured readers at the Dogfish Reading Series, Thursday, April 21st at 7 at 2448 North Villery. Poet Valentine Pierce presents a spring poetry workshop for adults at the Alvar Branch Library, Saturday, April 23rd and 30th, and May 7th, 14th, and 21st at 1:30 at the Alvar Branch. Every Child Ready to Read presents a workshop for kids up to age 5, Fun with Math and Science, Tuesday, April 26th at 11 at Smith Library. Howard Bloom discusses in Signs The Last Good Night, a World War II story of espionage, adventure, and betrayal, Tuesday, April 26th at 6 at the U.S. Freedom Pavilion, National World War II Museum. The New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival is upon us, and the New Orleans Gulf South Booksellers Association will be doing their thing in the book tent, next to the CD tent. Proceeds from book sales there benefit literacy projects in New Orleans. Here are the authors who are scheduled to appear, but you never know who might drop by. Friday, April 22nd, Michael Murphy signs Hear Dat from noon to 1. Keith Polk signs Mardi Gras Fish from 1 to 2. Saturday, April 23rd, Michael Allen Zell signs Run Baby Run from noon to 1. Todd Mouton signs Way Down in Louisiana from 1 to 2. Tom Piazza signs Free State from 3 to 4. Sally Asher signs Stories from New Orleans Cemeteries. And Megan Bacinelli signs New Orleans Neighborhoods from 4 to 5. Peggy Scott Laborde signs New Orleans Mardi Gras Moments from 5 to 6. Sunday, April 24th, Anne Benoit signs New Orleans Best Seafood Cookbook from noon to 1. Cheryl Gerber signs New Orleans Life and Death in the Big Easy from 1 to 2. Leon Morris signs Homage New Orleans from 4 to 5. And Laura Dragon signs Bayou Boogeyman Presents Hoodoo and Voodoo from 5 to 6. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.